All right, welcome back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here on a beautiful Sunday afternoon in the Sunstone Studios. Just a reminder, we will be having an open house here on June 8th. I think it's in the afternoon. I'm not certain, but it is on the Sunstone website, so you can mosey over there and come see this studio we're putting together for to stand until the millennium, so that we can record podcasts until Jesus returns. And the whole Sunstone Studios has been revamped and reorganized, and it's coming along really well. Speaking of Sunstone, today I have a guest here that I am been really excited to talk to. I don't think he knows this, but I'm a huge fan. I've been for a long time. I'm a little bit fangirling right now, actually. Now, so we have one of the old-time Sunstone folks, Stephen Carter. Stephen.
You think I'm old-time?
Well, you've only been
here for 11 years, man.
Well, didn't you ever... You were involved with Sunstone before that, right?
It's true. I was writing for them for about 5 years before I came around.
So
the editorship.
Stephen is one of those guys that the rest of us wish we could be. And, you know, there's always these, whenever you get in any sort of movement or organization, there's always these people that are behind the scenes that don't seek the limelight all the time, but who are intelligent and thoughtful. Stephen is one of those guys. He's got a great mind. You've been writing and editing and doing stuff like that. You've been the Sunstone magazine editor for how many years now?
I'm coming up on 11.
11 years. You edited the printed material. We're going to come back into that more. But you've been publishing stuff for longer than that.
Oh, I suppose so. Yeah, I started off by publishing a book called The Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer. It was a collection of sugar beet articles for those who were...
Were you involved with the sugar beet?
I was one of the founders. I came up with the title.
So the sugar beet was... This was the 2000s, just starting the 90s. This was the 2000s. It was playing on The Onion.
Right.
And but the articles were Utah and Mormon Center, and they were hilarious. I loved it. Stephen is also a comic book writer.
It's true.
And you guys, with your partner, what's your partner's name?
Jet Atwood.
Jet Atwood did the drawing, and you wrote the storyboard, right?
Yes.
And you guys did the Book of Mormon as comic books.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, because that's how the Book of Mormon is written.
As a comic book?
Well, yeah, comic books exist in myth space, right?
To be perfectly honest with you, the Book of Mormon... was dreadfully dull to me for most of my life. And so it was interesting to start going into it in a comic book format, because when you go into comic book format, you see the expressions of the people, and comic books become about people. And we went to Zenith.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's like, who's Zenith? Zenith was the guy who went off with the army to go defeat the Lamanites and found out that the Lamanites were all like family people who were just fine, and went back to his army, and the army tried to kill him, but instead ended up killing each other. And then he went and immigrated to the land of Nephi, where the Lamanites were, and it went really bad from there. That's where we get King Noah. That's where we get Abinadi. That's where we get all the slavery of Alma's people, all of that stuff. And it all started with this one guy who started seeing a different perspective. And the interesting thing about the Book of Mormon going into that is that most of the time when we think about Mormonism and what its culture is like, what it loves the most is the happy ending.
Right.
When we go to church, we are all there for the happy ending. But in the Book of Mormon, it gets twisted and turned. So this guy who was, you know, doing the Christ-like thing of seeing the real people in the Lamanites goes into the land of the Lamanites, and things start getting really, really hairy. And you can't tell who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. I mean, a bunch of Nephites suddenly come in and occupy the land of the Lamanites. How does that feel to the Lamanites who are there, who are already living there? That was how I got to really like the Book of Mormon. I found out that once you dig in, once you get past the seminary videos and the Sunday school classes, and you go in and you look at these people and say, oh my gosh, Zenith tried to do the right thing, and it led to genocide. It gets really interesting.
So after you did that, what part of the book came alive as you guys were framing this out?
Well, it got really interesting once we finished up the first volume, iPlates Volume 1. iPlates, playing on iNephi and iPads, so iPlates, because it comes from golden plates. It was a terrible name, but we're going on with it. So iPlates, Volume 1, it was actually a collection of five-page comic stories that Jet and I put together. And we realized when we got done with that there were no female characters who did and said things that were important to the plot. And we felt bad about that.
I don't know that I'm glad you felt bad about it. I don't know if it's your fault.
It wasn't our fault because we were just sort of following the text the best we could. But when we went into Volume 2, that was going to be a 150-page epic, we said, we want to figure out how women interacted with this story. And the part of the story that we'd come up to is when Alma gets kicked out of the palace. And so we started building females into the plot. And you know what? I think that it got way more interesting. Once we had female perspectives and female values in the stew. And when we got to the end of the book, I actually think we may have discovered something that actually happened that most people attribute to men, but I think women did it. And I'm going to leave that as a mystery so that people will go out en masse and buy iPlates Volume 2.
Now, what I like about what you guys did is you were able to engage it as dream space, as myth, which is what scriptures really are, and when you boil down to it. And I think if you get outside of orthodox paradigms that we're used to being in, you know, evangelicals or Mormons or whatever, those folks like to say it's literal, but most people don't engage religion on a literal basis. And that's why I think the comic book format is so great.
And the funny thing is, you can engage the Book of Mormon as being a literal history and simultaneously engage it as dream space. Because to tell you the truth, that's what we do with our own lives. I mean, we have these literal lives with these literal pasts, and we make stories out of them. And then we live as if those stories are literal. When in fact, the stories that we tell about ourselves and about our past and things, that is told from our perspective, relying on a brain that retains like 0.0005% of everything we encounter.
Right.
And then it loses everything from there. And you tell this story and it becomes more and more a myth about you.
Well, yes. And we see that all the time. And we talk about how we engage George Washington, mm-hmm. or Socrates, or King Arthur. Mm-hmm. You know, these things that the Arthurian legends are important to British identity, mm-hmm. and to contextualizing their past. We don't even know if the guy ever existed. Did you know what I'm saying?
But he made an impact.
He made an impact. And that's to say, we're not going to discuss those legends. We're not going to talk about Guinevere or Lancelot at all because we don't believe they were real people. You're going to miss out on how the British people deal with their own past and their own identity. And I think that's true with Mormons too. To cut the Book of Mormon out, to say, we don't think it's true. And I'm doing air quotes because we use words like true to talk about churches and books, and you can't talk about the truth with big complex things like that. It doesn't make any sense. You can't have a true church. Like, there's things the church says that are good. There's things that they believe that are absolutely true. There's things that they believe that are false. There's things that they do either deliberately or inadvertently that cause people pain. But to lump all that together and label it true or false is a false dichotomy.
But what is it that people are saying when they say that it's true?
You know, I've been thinking about that question for a lot of years. The more I think about it, the less I know. What do you think they're saying?
Now, actually, what you just said, I think, is one of the most important things that we can say about that particular subject. When we're trying to head into truth space, often what we're actually doing is we're heading into tension space. A lot of Mormon thought and a lot of Mormon testimony and a lot of Mormon discourse is mostly about trying to make things as literal as possible so that we know exactly which step we need to take next. to us, that's the most important thing about truth, because we're a very pragmatic people. We gathered that pragmatism from a very valid source, which was years of running around, being bad neighbors, being persecuted, feeling like the end was about to be here, and then finding out that it was just destroying us. And then this insanely pragmatic man named Brigham Young came along, and by gum, he saved us. And ever since then, we've equated truth with pragmatism. And we say, if it works in a on a literal level, if we can point to its results and quantify them, then that is truth. And if you look at our general conferences, you can see that happening. We quantify the things that happened that show that what we believe is truth. But when you really start to go into what truth is, that's when things start to get both interesting and complex and simple and really hard to gather a people around so that they can all do the same thing. And so you saying, the more I think about what truth is, the less I know, I think you're getting somewhere.
Well, I like how you frame it out as a pragmatic approach, because I think there's two other things that we tend to leave out of the story. You know, in the 1830s, when the 12 went to England, we tell the story about the 12 converting, you know, the English seekers who came here and helped build Zion, which was true. But they brought with them all of the baggage from what they were dealing with in England and what they were dealing with in Denmark and in Sweden. And most of these people were poor who were suffering from the recessions, and they really wanted a pragmatic restart. You know, they left everything behind to come here at great cost. So I do see that pragmatism coming here. If you take somebody who, you know, their kids were starving, in Copenhagen, they join the church, they come out, they end up in San Pete County, you know, like trying to raise potatoes in the high desert. This is a very pragmatic person. If you sat down with them and started discussing whether or not Nephi actually existed, I don't think they'd have much tolerance for that conversation.
And it's interesting to look at how that interacts with what we're doing now. You and I both have transgender children.
Yes.
And we came to a point where we said, being in this church is a difficult thing because it doesn't help me practically. And I need practical help with my transgender child in this culture where it's kind of new. I don't know what's going on. Nobody around me knows what's going on. Is there anybody with some wisdom here who is willing to bring me into a community that can help? And the Mormon church isn't there right now.
Like Mormonism and religion in general are not working for people in the same ways. Partly what you're saying, there's gender identity, LGBT issues, issues of immigration, and we have these myths that said, okay, the Lamanites are brown people because God doesn't like them, but they're going to turn white. I don't think there's anybody who that myth speaks to anymore at all. But you don't have to go that far back in time till you find people who it empowered. I've talked to Navajos today who still hold Spencer W. Kimball to be a special prophet who spoke to them and spoke to their identity. But I think that identity is kind of crashing down, and it's not a unidirectional thing. Oh, this isn't working, so I need to go from here to here. I think a lot of people, including strong believers who love the church, are putting their hands up in the air. And I think you see that with Nielsen and the church. Like, the changes they're making rapidly right now are fascinating, but it's not clear where the church is going or what problem they're trying to solve. Does that make sense?
Why do you think they made, like, the last four big changes that we're all kind of aware of? Rescinding the November 2015 policy, the changes in the covenants, the covenant language at the temple, and missionary stuff.
And then being able to get married secularly.
Being able to get married. Those four things. Who are they targeting?
Well, they're targeting millennials, right? They're targeting, okay. Well, not just, we keep talking about millennials. Millennials are actually aging, right? Millennials are in their 30s and their late 20s now. It's this next generation that our kids are. And from everything I read, the bleed rate for those kids is just off the charts. Like if you're 20 in the church today, you don't care for the most part about LGBT, like, pushback. Mm-hmm. You just accept that's just part of the world.
Every time one of those changes happened, it was interesting to see how much pushback there was from the people that I thought would be happy. including me. I was observing my own behavior when they rescinded the policy of exclusion. I was surprised at how angry I was. And I thought, why am I angry? It wasn't because I wanted the policy to still be there. I hated the policy.
I was angry too, and I know why I'm angry, but I want to hear why you are first.
The reason why I was angry was because I felt like this was supposed to be a relational thing between me and the church, and it turned out that it was just a policy. So I think that what we have in this generation of children that is coming up, that it seems like the church is targeting, saying, please stay, what do we have to do to make you stay? I think they're missing the main point, which is that they want a relationship with the church. And it's easy to have a relationship with the church at the beginning, when you're a child, or when you're in a child-parent relationship with the church, which is what they promote. They are the patriarchs who send down the word of God so that we can be led, guided, walked, besided. And that works while you're in that space. But then a lot of people, and especially the younger people, start making this transition, and they realize that they want a colleague or a sibling relationship with the church. They want it to be so that when they make changes like this, instead of it just coming down and saying, here it is, this is the new thing, and the church explicitly says, this was not because of this, it was not because of anything anyone said, this is just what happened. Like when they had the first woman pray in General Conference in who knows how long, they explicitly said, this is not because of any of the things that have been happening. You can go back to the record and read that. And that is what they've maintained each time they've made one of these announcements. It's been a contextless announcement that, you know, you could say, well, there's Exponent 2, there's Feminist Mormon Housewives, there's Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, there's Margaret Toscano, there's, you know, all of these people who for 40 years have been talking about making those language changes in the temple, and suddenly it's here, and isn't it great that they made that happen? But from the church's point of view, what they actually say is, this simply happened.
If they say anything at all.
If they say anything at all.
They're not even as explicit as what you are. You know, that's what you're crediting them for. Sometimes it's just like they make the change. And some of these big policies we're talking about the last 5 years, they don't make them at conference. They just go out on a press release Friday night at 6, yeah. You know?
But sometimes they also say, do not talk about this. That's what happened with the change in the temple. And so I think that that's the thing that's been bothering people so much, is that they realized that they wanted a relationship with the church, and the church doesn't know how to have a relationship.
But more personally, why did it make you angry?
The policy of exclusion irrevocably altered my family. And I want to be a part of the LDS Church. It's in my bones. Mm. I know the language. It's got something unique in it that resonates with my soul. And I felt like they were saying, we just want to keep on giving you things from on high. We want to continue to be your parent. We don't want you to grow up. My dad is insanely intelligent. He has like 150 patents to his name. So as I was growing up, I was kind of terrified by him. Whenever I'd play Risk, he would mop the walls with me. I was terrible at those things. But then when I went and I got my graduate degree and I started to understand things and I started to get my own ideas, then one day I came home and I sat with my dad and we talked. And by gum, we had a conversation of equals.
Wow.
And it was so much fun. And my relationship with my dad became so different. We were partners. We were making things together. He and I even got together with my wife and we did a patent, something I never thought I could do. And then I helped him write his novel. It was so much fun. But with the LDS Church, I feel like it's saying, no, there is a wall between me and you. I will always be older than you. I will always be wiser than you. And you should never start to think that you could be part of this and that you could do anything that would change what's going on here. Even though they've made all these changes that I'm so happy about,
yeah,
it still feels like it's just like a gumball that comes out of the machine. So that was what B.F. Skinner discovered, right?
Uh-huh.
Was that the lever that the rats would push the most was the one where it was randomized whether the food pellet would come out. And that's kind of what it feels like. It feels like I'm a rat who constantly tries to push the little lever, and sometimes something comes out enough so that they hope that they can keep me around. And the funny thing is, I just want a relationship. And I think that's what everybody who's like younger than us are missing, is a relationship.
The one that that actually impacted me the most, that got me the most angry, was the one from a week or two ago, or just a few days now, where they've said there's no longer a waiting period for the temple. And the reason is because that policy, even on a personal level, but around, has caused so much pain and heartache for individuals and families. Controlling marriages and weddings and excluding people has done so much violence to so many families. And just to simply reverse that policy and say nothing is insulting to all of the people who have paid a high price. That's the real conundrum I think they find themselves in. Because if they say that it's revelation and it's part of the eternal plan, they got explaining to do why it's not anymore. But if they say it's not, then they have even more explaining to do as to why the hell they were doing this to people for so long. And what I'm annoyed at them for is they want to make the change, they want the benefit of the change. They want to create an environment where these Generation Z or the millennials are plugged in, but they don't want to do any of the work. They don't want to pay any of the cost. And what they really need to do is start coming forward and saying, we are sorry. This hurt a lot of people, and we are seeking repentance. We are seeking forgiveness.
The thing that they want to do is to retain members, and I don't blame them. And frankly, I would like them to retain members. When I see a lot of the kids who are growing up right now, my younger brothers and sisters, my own children, I think, what would the church be like if we had all of these people starting to go into leadership positions? And I like what I see.
Hmm.
It makes me sad that a lot of these people are leaving kind of the community and becoming and sending their energies in all these different directions. The Mormon Church is really good at making things happen. And if we had this kind of new heart grow up in a context where we could make things happen, I think we'd be an extraordinary people. Yeah, so sometimes I think about this stuff, and I think, what can we do? What can we do to keep these beautiful hearts in the church, where they could make our lives so much richer? And the funny thing was, I actually came up with something that was kind of simple and easy. I don't know. I'm going to pitch it to you. You tell me if you think...
If I'm ready to join your branch of the church.
Yeah. Okay, so this is what I think. I think that the most difficult thing about keeping all these people in the church comes down to one metaphor. And that is, at the end of our talks, we always say, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. And everybody says amen, right? And so what that's supposed to mean, at least from what I've heard, is that everyone is supposed to be of one mind when it comes to whatever it is the person up there has said. The problem is, that's never the case. 100% of the time, right? But we sit in sacrament meeting, we hear, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen, we say amen. Then we sit in our classrooms, and people say things as if they're saying, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen, at the end of whatever comment they say, and we feel like there's this big current that's pushing us along, and the only way that we can interact with it is to either go with the current or go against the current. And if we go against the current, then we'll be accused of contention.
Mm.
And people are going to say, what's the matter with you? And so we can never express ourselves. There isn't a place to express being human.
Even confusion. Or having a legitimate question that can be at all seen as antagonistic is so frowned upon.
Right. I think that if at the beginning of every talk they said, I'm about to say a few things that have come from my own experience and study, and they mean a lot to me, and they've helped me. However, as I look around this congregation, I see that there are a lot of people here, and that means that not everybody's going to agree with me. and I'm really excited to talk to you about it afterward. And then give the talk. And then, during classroom discussions, after somebody makes a particularly pointed comment or argument, then the teacher could say, "Thank you so much for sharing that. You've really opened my perspective on this. There's enough people in this classroom that there's doubtless somebody with a different perspective or a different experience. I'd like to hear from you now."
Mm-hmm.
I think if we did that one thing, just making room with a set of words so that people would say, "Oh, my different opinion is invited to this conversation," I think we'd retain, I don't know, 60, 70% of all those people who are leaving simply because they would see room for them to talk.
Last time I went to church, 2005 in the fall, probably in October, and we having the lesson on Isaac and Jacob. Putting the boy on the altar and God wanting to sacrifice his son. And we went through it.
Abraham and Isaac.
Abraham and Isaac. Okay. Yeah. Jacob came later. Abraham and Isaac. So we're having that lesson and the teacher is framing this all out as this very positive, like great story. And I'm getting increasingly, and I really, I know I have a reputation as an agitator. I can be, but that's not the way I was at church. You know, I went to church for community and I legitimately raised my hand and say, "I'm having a big problem with this story because should we really like do something like kill our children if God tells us to?" I mean, we would frame that out as mental illness now. And it was interesting because I thought I would just be person alone, you know, but I felt like I needed to stand with a fist. But there were actually quite a few people in that Sunday school lesson who, because the first thing that came at me was an attack. And then people started coming to my defense. There were actually quite a few. I'd say a third of the room was quiet. A third of the room was arguing my side that, yes, we need to be careful about this stuff. That you know, because everybody knows stories of Lafferty's and different people whose revelation has led to really terrible things. But what's interesting, it wasn't there was a pro side to my argument and a con side. There was a pro side, and the con side was you shouldn't be asking this question. The agitation and the anger that was sent back at me and the others was, we shouldn't be having this discussion. This is off limits. And I think that limits us so much because in this we would go back to Sunstone. When I discovered Sunstone twice, once when I was a college student and once when I was struggling, it probably helped me maintain my membership in the church longer. To be able to engage the hard questions and know that we can sometimes say, "Geez, I don't know," speaks more to somebody like me.
One of the things that I know that people would criticize me about my little idea about making room for all the other views is, "Well, Stephen, won't that dissipate the power that a Mormon has, the mythological power? The reason why we are able to get together and make things happen so well is because we all have the same story. We're all willing to say, yes, that's a good direction to go. We're all going to go in that direction. And we reenact that in microcosm each Sunday. Why would we want to make our classrooms and our sacrament meetings into places where lots of different experiences and thoughts about a subject come together and interact with each other? Won't that make us less spiritual, less effective, less Mormon?" And the thing that comes to my mind is that when we think about the baptismal covenant, the one that Alma gave, he said that the most important things about the baptismal covenant was, one, mourn with those who mourn, second, comfort those who stand in need of comfort, and third, stand as a witness of God in all times, places. And to me, that's exactly what it is that I'm trying to say, is that we need to mourn, we need to follow our baptismal covenant. And the more we don't follow that baptismal covenant, the less Christian and the less Mormon we are. When we're worshiping a doctrine or a current, a theological current or a discourse, we're missing the whole point of being Mormon. To me, what we're finding out now with this mass exodus from the church, and we'll quibble about the exodus, is that... The people who are growing up are more interested in the people than they are in the theology. And that's what I think the brethren would do very well to start thinking about, is how can we make this into mourn with those who mourn and comfort those who stand in need of comfort? And I'm totally with standing as a witness of God in all times and places, because God, is a loving being. And that's what we're trying to become. We're trying to become creators. We're trying to become loving creators. And so I know that there's somebody in the church office building who is listening to this. Hi, send this on up. This is my idea.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
All right, so let's talk about Sunstone, because I think Sunstone is one of the solutions to these problems, which is why I'm here, and I would assume one of the reasons you've been involved with the organization for a long time. So I've told this story before. The magazine was a breath of fresh air for me as a young college student in like 1991 when I discovered it. And I saw what I was missing in the church. It had poetry. It had comics. It had personal essays. It had historical essays, and it was packed full of all this stuff. And of course, we're coming at that time. It was still the golden age of publishing. You know, there were magazines and all this kind of stuff. And I would suggest you get a hold of a copy of Sunstone magazine, because it is fantastic, and it remained that way even through the years you've been involved. Well, not even, but maybe especially because of your stuff. I really, no matter how burned out on Mormonism I was, Sunstone was always something that I could connect with.
So running Sunstone magazine for the past 11 years has been an interesting experience, because I came on when Obama was president. Sniff, sniff. Blogs were just getting big. Podcasts were just getting big. Facebook was just getting big. And it was a real time of transition. Sunstone was started when print was the way that you got information out. And so print is a difficult thing to actually put together, especially back when we started. I mean, you had to, like, I'm not even going to go into that. It was such a cumbersome process. And so when you put out a magazine, you didn't want to put out crap. You wanted to put out something that was really worth reading, not just because it took you forever to put the magazine together and print it and send it out to everybody, but because you wanted the people who read the magazine to think it was good and keep paying for it. And so we developed a really strong editorial culture. We had basically three parameters for being in Sunstone. One, you had to have something to say. Two, it had to be something new to say. And three, it had to be said beautifully. Mm. The problem is, most people don't meet those three criteria. Just because, you know, we're human and we don't pay a lot for the articles. And so that's why we would have the editors that we had. And editors would work long and hard to make sure that these articles were worth reading, were worth the print, were worth people's time, because it takes a lot of work to read stuff. And so Sunstone was born and raised in that culture, in that print culture, where what you wrote and printed and sent out into the world really mattered. You weren't going to send out something that somebody had already said before and send it out without knowing what was going on. I mean, that's the whole point of a discourse, is that you keep building on what has come before. so that you can make progress.
Right.
And so when we had these print publications, and you can, you know, you could keep track of them. We had BYU Studies, we had Exponent, we
Dialogue.
Had Dialogue, we had Sunstone, mm-hmm. And these others. Then you could keep track of what the discourse was. So then, when the internet came along, and God bless the internet, it has blessed my life. It was actually, as we were talking about, kind of what got me going in my career with the sugar beet. So when the internet came along, what happened was everybody who had a thought and who could articulate it could put it up on the web, and people would read it. And the first thing that I noticed it hitting was my letters to the editors section, because then everybody was talking to each other about what was going on in Sunstone instead of sending it to me, because that was how the blog thing used to work in the print age, which you send a letter to the editor. Well, they just dried up. And so that was the sort of thing that started to disappear. Our knowledge of what the discourse was and people being willing to put in the work to advance the discourse. It suddenly became very easy to come into your faith crisis, and even though you wouldn't intellectually believe it, believing in your gut that you were the first one there and that you were the first one who had this idea, and the blog posts would turn over so quickly, and now the Facebook group posts go by so quickly you have no way of finding them again. Things just disappear into the morass of words that are going on out there. It's become so that we don't really know what the past is, what's been said before. We can't build on what's already there, so we keep running around,
in circles. You're just blowing my mind, because you've articulated very clearly something that's bothered me for some time. 10, 15 years ago, when I was involved in discussions with apologists and other people online, like you're saying, there was this expectation that they knew a modicum of basic Mormon stories, that if you said, well, look at Dialogue number 14, number 3, they would even know what you were talking about. That people knew that a place where a lot of even subversive work got snuck in under the covers was BYU Studies. So BYU Studies was a great magazine for Mormon culture and history. It was more faithful, but you could get some fantastic articles. The famous 1968 article that dissects the different accounts of the Joseph Smith's first vision is still the seminal work. Anybody who wants to talk about that needs to read that Dialogue article. And you can see over and over again that they haven't. It's people waking up, and we don't even have a common language anymore. And it's because of it's not a Mormon thing. It's the democratization of the internet. And democracy means anybody, no matter how dumb they are, can say anything they want. Oh, that was terrible, but it's true.
The internet used to be the sandbox where people would play before going off into the real world and making something that added to the discourse. But now the internet is the world. That is where the dialogue happens, and it's a pastless dialogue, which means we can't make any progress.
And what's frustrating for me is all of the issues that we're talking about were dealt with in great depth in the 60s and 70s by the baby boomers. like we feel like we've invented all these issues, but they were already around. And because they were subversive, they did it in a much more polite way, which makes it much more accessible.
Mm-hmm. But we do need to say one really important thing, which is that each person who does discover these things is discovering these things in their soul, and it is the first time that it's happened.
That's a good point.
This is one of the reasons why, to me, we need a community that is like Sunstone. I know we're tooting our own horn.
I think we can. This is actually Sunstone's podcast.
I was lucky. When I went to college, I was a full-time news reporter, and Eugene England had just been hired on as UVU's writer in residence, and I interviewed him, got to know him, and then I took his Mormon literature class, and then I somehow became his administrative assistant.
Okay, you're going to come back. I love Eugene, and he's enigmatic to me in some ways, but the older I get, the more I'm in love with him. And I'm afraid in the last 10 years people have forgotten. So we're going to come back, and we're going to do a whole episode on Eugene.
It was an interesting time to get to know him. He had a National Endowment for the Humanities grant that allowed him to bring in all of these sort of Mormon rock stars from back then. So I got to interact with people like Wayne Booth,
oh, wow.
Armand Moss, Colleen McDaniel, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich,
uh-huh.
Even Terrell Givens, back when he was just a baby and he only had one book out. And it was an extraordinary experience for me because he would not only have these public lectures with these people, but he'd also have small symposia, which were like a dozen people, which were all scholars. And for some reason, he let me sit in on these.
Wow.
I was just this little undergrad. And so I got to hear what it was like to discuss Mormonism in a scholarly and interesting and productive way. This was really helpful for me because I knew it could happen. And then the other thing that I saw was that, as you mentioned, he had been forced into retirement, from what he told me, specifically because of an article that he had written and for a dialogue. And it was really hard on him. It was so hard on him. He loved the church, and it broke his heart. He sat me down one day and said, "I just can't believe I heard the things that I heard from the men who I believe have authority from God."
Oh, man.
And just watching him deal with that, and he was never bitter. He was always looking for something. He was always faithful. And so watching this man of extraordinary intellect, of extraordinary compassion, doing his utmost to stay in that tension that he was experiencing was sort of my other lesson. I got to see, one, what it was like to see people talk about Mormonism productively, intelligently, and then I got to watch Gene England build his soul in such a difficult way. And I started to realize what it was he was doing after I read a lot of his work. What he was doing was he was trying to follow Joseph Smith's adage, by proving contraries, truth is made manifest.
Yes.
You can even find that in a real live church-produced book. Eugene England's interpretation of that wasn't that Joseph Smith was saying, when you prove which contrary is true, then you will have truth. What he meant was, when you stay in the tension between two contraries, it opens you. And that's what he was doing. He was staying in the tension of the contraries, and it was opening him. And so he died about a week after I left for graduate school. And while I was in graduate school, I started writing personal essays about Mormonism. And while I was doing this, I was a new writer. I didn't know what I was doing. But I felt this pull between two contraries. One was the contrary that said, everything you write should be supporting the church and saying how great it is and building people's faith. And then the other contrary was saying, everything that you should write should be to tear down the church and to destroy faith because it's all a lie. And both of them laid claim to truth. And it was the strangest feeling, as I was writing these essays, to feel pulled back and forth between these two contraries until I realized what was going on. And I said, I need to find a way to stay between these two contraries and see what opens up. I realized that going in either direction was failing to build my soul. I would be complimented on either side by different groups of people, but I wouldn't build my soul because I would be getting out of the tension.
Wow.
That was the mindset that I brought with me when I came to Sunstone to edit. What we're doing here is we're creating a space where people can stay in the tension so that their souls can be opened. To me, that's the important thing. We can't just choose our way out of it. We have to stay in the tension.
Yeah, for a lot of years, I was just like, the church is harmful, but I'm living that tension now that I still believe the corporate church in much of the doctrine and dogma, you know, like what they say about the universe, in my view, is not only just wrong, a lot of it is harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm at this place where the proving contraries, where I see the benefit and the joy and the support the church gives to some people, the sense of identity that, that enlivens them and sets them on a path of goodness and virtue. But I see the harm. I see the cultish behavior. I see the, and I'm trying to learn to sit with those things. And it is hard because I find myself being pulled one way or the other, you know, just saying, oh, we're all just doing our best and trying our best. That's not satisfying because there's real harm. We talked about our transgender children.
It's true.
And the community, whether they like it or not, does violence to these kids. Mm-hmm. just by even people who are well-meaning.
But especially by people who are well-meaning.
Especially by people who are well-meaning. Yeah, and so that does resonate with me. And again, I think Sunstone is one of the few organizations that's been able to weave that.
That's because it's our mission statement. It's our mission statement to provide the forum where people can stay in the tension.
Uh-huh. And I used to go to the ex-Mormon conferences. They don't happen anymore. But there's something that I like better at Sunstone, listening to, like, polygamists and people who and fundamentalists and food storage people and just engaging. That's why the summer conference from Sunstone, I keep telling everybody, you have to come out, because we do reach some of what you're talking about, because people are presenting, they have to prepare.
Oh yeah.
So the level of discourse is much, much higher than what you see on the boards, but it's not quite fully to a published level, which makes it
engagement. That's my job. I go and find the stuff that's worthy to get published, and then we work with it.
So now we're recording the magazine. So this is your baby. So tell us how we're breaching new media these days.
Right. So Sunstone was born in print, and I am a thorough subscriber to the idea that we absolutely need to know what the discourse has been and to put a lot of work into forwarding that discourse. But the problem is, people don't have a lot of time. I don't have a lot of time to read. The only way that I read is on my phone. That's the only place I get any time. And I do much better when I get to listen to it.
Yep.
That's the tyranny of reading. It takes over your whole body. You have to sit down. You have to use your hands to hold the book, and you have to use your eyes to look at the book. You can't do anything else. And people don't have time for that.
No, you're right. You're right.
So I realized how much I like listening to books. And in fact, sometimes how much more I get out of the text when I get to listen to a human intone what's going on. And so I decided, well, I guess that's what I need to do in order to get Sunstone into the ear holes of more people. Get more people to be able to partake of what we have here, because I think people will really like it. I think they'll feel that their intellect and their souls nourished by sort of the weight of all of the work that the writers have put in, that the editors have put in, all of the weight of the discourse that we're implicitly working with, so that we can bring this to a new level. And so each week I record an article or two, and I put it up on patreon.com/sunstone, and also magazine subscribers receive an email with a link to the article, and people get to listen to it. I think that I'm right in doing this, but you can push back on me if you want. I think that people should pay for it, because it takes so darn much work to put this all together.
If you took all the money for all these organizations, all the nonprofits that are functioning in this space, and added it up, it's probably under the operational budget of one stake, for sure.
Doubtless.
That there's been all these people do this great work, and if you want really good stuff, you have to pay for it. So to get a subscription, an annual subscription to Sunstone Magazine is $75 a year. Mm-hmm. And for that, they'll get all this recording. There's editing that goes on. You are a full-time employee of Sunstone.
Yes.
And so it takes at least one full-time person, plus all the other people who pitch in to make this happen. So that $75 gets you that annual thing. It helps support Sunstone in general and these other endeavors, and pays for the print. Now you still get a print with the current subscription. No.
Yeah, the change that's being made is I'm going to put out one more normal 8x10 magazine-like issue, and then after that I'm going to put out yearly digests where all the material is put into sort of a 6x9 form that's going to be pretty much just words, because right now Sunstone is also art, mm-hmm. things like that. but it's going to be words. But you're going to get to be able to listen to it. So yes, you get the recordings, and you get all the words with all the end notes at the end. And let me tell you, I spend time on those end notes because I think end notes are interesting. They send you in all sorts of different directions.
I love the end notes. I saw Mike Quinn a couple weeks ago. He was down at Short Creek, and I told him, you know, I've been wanting to say thank you for a long time. And I said, Mike, I read all of your footnotes, which is, if you've read his books, they're more footnotes than they are actual text.
Pages.
But you, if you're going to read anything Mike Quinn writes, you have to read the footnotes because that's where all the gems are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really important work. And you know, when Trump was elected, I was sad, like a lot of people. And then I realized I had to do something. So the first thing I did is I subscribed to New York Times and to Salt Lake Tribune. Because we are also used to so much free content that we have to figure out ways to support these things. And this is one of those things that needs to be supported. Every year, you know, the operational cost of things like this goes up. And it would take so little from a lot of people to keep this up and running. And the reason that we do four episodes or four magazines a year instead of eight or whatever is just because of resources, you know?
That's it.
There's enough content that we could produce a monthly, but we would take 20 more employees, you know?
Right.
And have you gone back to the audio from the Sunstone conferences yet?
No, I'm only doing the magazine content because that is where everything is most distilled.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if the scholar or the writer is saying things perfectly, exactly the way they want to say it, instead of off the cuff or at a symposium or something. This is where you get to hear it in all of its beauty.
So we have, right now, the Sunstone, we have four podcasts that we put out. We have the one you're talking about with the magazine, the one that you're listening to right now. We have the Fireside podcast. And then, of course, we have Brian's Mormon History that he and Lindsay are doing where they take a deeper dive. There's a fifth podcast that I was pushing on Lindsay for, but we need a little bit more resource to do it, which is Sunstone has been recording the Sunstone Conference for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
We have this treasure trove of all of these talks by everyone you've ever heard of.
Everyone.
And what I want is another podcast that where we have somebody, maybe Steven, maybe somebody else, who goes through and curates those. I know I listened to 10, 15 years ago, the September 6th, 10 years later.
Oh, yeah.
They brought them all into a room and they talked about their experience. It was phenomenal to listen to. It's sitting out there in the archive. The reason I'm telling you this, dear listener, is we need more money from you all. No, not a lot, just a little. And then we can continue to take what Sunstone has done and the kind of great work that Stephen has done and make it more widely accessible. Because I think there's a lot of people who are getting fatigued off of Reddit and all it's disposable. It's in the National Enquirer. And at some point, we're eating junk food. And there's so many scholars and intelligent people. And that hasn't gone away. It's just there's just as many fascinating people studying Mormonism today as 40 years ago. But they just get drowned out by the noise, like we said in the beginning.
Yeah.
Unless you're a loudmouth blowhard, you don't rise to the top of people's zeitgeist or whatever. And we need to turn that around and start talking to people. Not just the loudest and the most wordy, but the people who really know what they're talking about.
Totes.
I don't mean to sound like all of this is dying. I think quite the contrary. I think there's hunger for it, and we just have to figure out how to cut through the noise.
We need our community, and frankly, I think Mormonism is a totally viable community if we can start engaging with our baptism covenants truly. And I think that Sunstone is an essential community because it's the place where we can all talk together as whole human beings. There are two levels of community. One of the levels of community is that you find that a part of you is breathing that hasn't breathed in a long time. And that happened to me at my first Sunstone. I went and I said, why do I suddenly feel like I can breathe?
Uh-huh.
It was because I could start talking with people about about things that I haven't been able to work with. And after you go through a number of these times of finding out that you can breathe because you're with people who are willing to listen to you, and you find out that you're willing to listen to them, then you start to become whole because all of you is starting to breathe. And the only place that you can really breathe well is with other people, because they make the room for you to breathe, and you can see that they're breathing in their own different way, so you can breathe in your own different way. And then once that happens enough, then you hit the second level, which is where you find out that you, in all your uniqueness, are essential to the life of that community, and that without you, it wouldn't be as beautiful as it is. Mm. And so that can happen in a Mormon congregation. That can happen in a Mormon classroom. I actually think it's much more likely to happen in a classroom. I have very little faith in what can happen in very large groups.
Right.
I have a lot of faith in what can happen in a group of about a dozen people. And so I know very few groups where there is as much potential for having those two kinds of community happening, those two kinds of soul growth happening. One, where you start to breathe, and then you find out that you are whole, that the person next to you is whole, that that other person is whole, and that the wholeness of each of you, even though you're all totally different, is making this a beautiful community, and that it wouldn't be the community it is without you. You are essential. And of course, that's not usually what happens in a Mormon classroom. What usually happens is that we are all cogs who are spitting out the doctrine of the day. That helps some things, but it doesn't make for community. But to me, Mormonism is a place that I found where that community can happen. And the other thing is to make sure that the independent voices in Mormonism can show us how to have these conversations. That's what helped me. That's what got me started. I knew that we could have these conversations, and I knew that it was hard to grow a soul. But Gene England taught me how to do it. And you can do both at Sunstone and at church. I actually don't care if you go to the Mormon church. Go to a church. Go to a bowling club. Go to the Kiwanis. Go to a place where you're not with people who all have the same idea you do. Hmm. Go to a place where you have to work with people and where you aren't the main show.
Everything you're saying really resonates with me, and I've arrived basically at the same place you are. I'm not quite ready to go back to the to the Brighton Fourth Ward or whatever I'm in. Although I have on my to-do list, I have my bishop's number taped to my computer. I've been meaning to call him to say, well, you know, what can we do together? And the reason I think Sunstone, to just underline what you're saying, it's just as much about what goes on in the halls. Matter of fact, the Sunstone veterans, yeah, the people who've been going for 100 years, they sometimes don't even go into the conferences because it's that individual connection. It's those individual conversations that are happening. Not that there's not always fascinating panels. And if you look at whoever's moving and shaking out there, they usually come to Sunstone. So if you want to hear what's going on in the world, they're there. Well, Steve, and I really appreciate your vision, and you're such a wealth of knowledge that we need to plumb a little bit more. Any last thoughts?
It would mean the world to me if people signed up through a Patreon or through the website and subscribed. I put my heart and soul into this, and I'd love to have anyone who wants to come along on the journey.
Well, I appreciate all the work you've done here. I'll leave this last thought because I think it resonates with what you're saying. When I first came onto this, I said, Lindsay, no one cares. No one wants to hear this. I used to be more sensationalist. I'm not a sensationalist anymore. No one's going to listen. And I think what's happened is there are people who read the magazine. There are people who listen to the podcast, and they're special people. And I'm starting to hear from them. And the work that you do matters. It's reaching some, and it's reaching some of the most thoughtful, interesting people out there. So for those of you who have that old school affection for published, curated, edited material, I would say please check out the great work Stephen's doing on the Sunstone magazine and everything you do. Well, thanks, brother. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Take care, man.